afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today is Samantha Silva, author of the recently published novel, Mr. Dickens and His Carol, a delightful reimagining of Charles Dickens writing his famous Christmas story. Because my own continuation of A Christmas Carol, The Further Adventures of Ebenezer Scrooge, was published in 2015, I was especially eager to have Samantha on the show, and I know we'll have some Dickensian stories to share. Samantha, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thank you for having me.
Usually I read the author's note last, but for this novel, I read it as soon as I finished reading the first chapter, and I discovered that this really is a novel. It's not just a novelized history. Why did you decide to write your own version of the events of 1843?
Well, a friend of mine had suggested years ago that we write a ghost story anthology about Dickens' invention of the carol, because she'd heard that that's how he came up with the story. But when I started to read about the true story of how Dickens came up with it, I became more intrigued, and also because of the possibilities, the story possibilities that suggested. I love the idea. As soon as I hear that his publishers came to him and threatened to deduct from his pay and announced that Martin Chuzzlewit is a flop and that he ought to come up with a Christmas book, which in truth was his idea, I thought, oh, that is a great conflict to have an author up against his publishers. He owes them money. He's in debt up to his ears. He's overextended in every possible way, takes care of his father, his relatives, and his own expanding, ever-expanding family and very expensive life. And I just saw an immediate conflict there. And the rest of it came from that.
So once you've made the decision that you were really writing a very fictionalized version of a novel and not trying to recreate the historical reality, and you sort of achieved that, the freedom that comes with that, what were you most excited about changing?
Well, I think that there is a lot of my trying to really get into Dickens' skin, to feel the truth of what it was for him to be that man and that author at that time, to be a celebrity, to have had sort of skyrocketed to fame, to walk around London, to be known by everybody. I wanted to keep all of that and as much as possible the verisimilitude of Victorian London. But I think as soon as you create the plot twist of him rejecting the idea of writing a Christmas book, it just creates so many great opportunities. And I knew also that I wanted him to be the source of A Christmas Carol, that it wasn't just an idea, it wouldn't be just an idea that sprung spontaneously from his imagination, but that it would arise from an experience that he himself had. And so that's why I really set about thinking, well, what would make Dickens feel Scrooge-like? What would be that adventure or that kind of descent that he would go on? And having this ready-made conflict about money and the book and the blackmail of the Christmas book sort of made it easy to write the rest, I have to say.
Yeah, I love these moments in the novel where Dickens really is almost becoming Ebenezer Scrooge, but it didn't feel forced. It felt like that could be any of us under financial stress, under difficulties with family and conflicts with work and with business. Almost any of us could turn into Ebenezer Scrooge at any moment.
I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, all artists of any kind do have that conflict of they want to practice their art. They want that to be their living and their lifeblood, but they also have to bring home the bacon. We all do. And so it's ironic that the true story is that Dickens thought about writing a Christmas book and he did it in 6 weeks because he needed a money spinner to get him out of debt to his publishers, and not to mention other debts that he had. And it didn't actually make him money at the time for a variety of reasons, but it has been a money spinner for so many artists ever since. I mean, there's, you know, the number of theaters across the country who rely on A Christmas Carol every year as their bread and butter is extraordinary still, and it was then.
It is amazing to me how when anybody lists their top five Christmas books, that book from 1843 is still always among them and often the one that's at the top of the list. Would you read to us a little bit of Mr. Dickens and his Carol?
I would, and I think that probably the best place to start is the beginning. This is chapter one. On that unseasonably warm November day at 1 Devonshire Terrace, Christmas was not in his head at all. His cravat was loose, top button of his waistcoat undone, study windows flung open as far as they'd go. Chestnut curls bobbed over his dark slate eyes that brightened to each word he wrote. This one, no, that one, scribble and scratch, a raised brow, a tucked chin, a guffaw. Every expression was at the ready, every limb engaged in the urgent deed. Nothing else existed, not hunger or thirst, not the thrumming of the household above and below, a wife about to give birth, 5 children already, 4 servants, 2 Newfoundlands, a Pomeranian, and the master's cat now pawing at his quill. Not time, neither past nor future, just the clear-eyed now and words spilling out of him faster than he could think them. The exhilaration of his night walk had led him straight to his writing chair by first morning without even his haddock and toast. He'd traversed twice the city in half his usual time, from Clerkenwell down Cheapside, across the Thames by way of Blackfriars Bridge and back by Waterloo, propelled by a singular vision. The throng of devoted readers that very afternoon pressing their noses against the window of Muddy's booksellers, no doubt awaiting the new Chuzzlewit installment, with its flimsy green cover, 33 pages of letterpress, 2 illustrations, various advertisements, and the latest chapter of pure delight by the inimitable Boz himself. Why, it was plain to him that humanity's chief concern, now that Martin Chuzzlewit had sailed for America, was the fate of Tom Pinch and the Pecksniffs, and he considered it his sacred duty to tell them. And so Charles Dickens didn't hear the slap bang of the door knocker downstairs that would alter the course of all his Christmases to come. Like any man, he'd known a good share of knocks in his 30-some years. Hard knocks at lesser doors, insistent rap, rap, raps on wind-bitten, rain-battered doors whose clenched nails had lost all hope of holding. And with fame came gentler taps at better doors, pompous pillared and crowned thresholds in glazed indigo paint, like his own door 2 floors below, where the now polite pounding was having no effect at all. Because there are times in a man's life when no knock on any door will divert him from the thing at hand, in particular when that thing is a goose feather pen flying across the page, spitting ink.
That's just lovely. I think as writers, we all envy that moment when you're in the zone, the way that you depict him in that first scene. So in my afterword to my little book, The Further Adventures of Ebenezer Scrooge, I say this about Charles Dickens. Though he may have been overcredited in the early 20th century for single-handedly both reviving the observance of Christmas and inventing our modern version of its celebration, he certainly played an important role in codifying many Christmas customs that remain in use to this day, from carol singing to tree decorating. Now, you depict many of these customs in Mr. Dickens and His Carol. How did you work to draw parallels between the early Victorian Christmas celebrations of 1843 and those that we still know today?
I've read quite a bit and quite a bit of conflicting things about, you know, Dickens and the sort of invention or reinvention of Christmas. And I quite agree with you, what you say in your afterword, that he is overcredited, that with reviving Christmas. I think Christmas was well on its way back after the Puritans had quashed it 2 centuries before. And, you know, carols, the singing Christmas carols had gone underground for a while and they came back. They were coming back and people were singing them again, singing them in the streets and everywhere they went. But I think that really what's more important about what Dickens did for Christmas actually was remind people what the spirit of Christmas was, which is, of course, a time to reconnect with our own humanity and I think revel in our own blessings, but also think of those who have less than we do. And he wrote the carol really because he wanted to deliver a sledgehammer blow for the poor. And for me, I mean, there is this beautiful confluence of the rise of Victorian Christmas traditions, very much in part due to Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, and, you know, the bringing of the raising of the Christmas tree and having a Christmas tree inside the house, the invention of the Christmas card. I think it was 1843 that the very first Christmas card was sent and thought of. But for me, what I really wanted to do was to use this journey of Dickens to help remind us what Christmas should really be about. You know, I think we do overcredit Dickens with sort of, you know, many of the commercial trappings of Christmas now. But in fact, that was not his idea at all. His idea was really about the gathering around the hearth and counting our blessings and remembering the people who have less than we do.
I think it's interesting you mentioned the Christmas card, and you do mention it in your book as well, because, as you said, the first Christmas card was created and mailed the same Christmas season that A Christmas Carol was published in 1843. And years ago, I had a friend who was an antiquarian bookseller who had a copy of the original Christmas card, and I got to hold it and to look at it. And it's very Dickensian, because in the middle panel, there is a family feasting around a table full of plenty. And then on the sides, there are these two depictions of charity to those less fortunate. There's one where they're giving some bread to a family, and another one where they're handing looks like they're handing a blanket to a cold woman. That image in that Christmas card, that original Christmas card, always put me in mind of what Dickens, and this is a little bit about what you just said, Dickens called his Christmas philosophy. And he used that term a lot later on, and it goes back to the words that Freddie says in the first stave of A Christmas Carol, when he calls Christmas a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time, the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem to, by one consent, to open their shut-up hearts freely and think of people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave. Did you have that particular passage, that very famous passage, in mind as you crafted your book? Because it does feel to me like that philosophy is behind your story as well.
Very much so. I love that. I mean, hearing you read it even now gives me chills. It's such a beautiful sort of thematic capturing of what Dickens was all about and what he wanted A Christmas Carol to be about. So it's just a kind of a beautiful condensation of everything he believed about what Christmas was.
So early in your book, Charles Dickens has an experience that most of us as writers have had at some point in our careers. He's written what he believes is his best work. He's working on Martin Chuzzlewit. It's being published in these monthly installments. But neither his publishers nor the public agree with him about the fact that he thinks it's his best work. Have you ever had experience like that with your own work, where your views of it were radically different from the views of the people who are reading it?
That ends up being a very, very intimate question, Charlie. I actually love to tell this story. I was married for a long time to a filmmaker, and I started as a screenwriter, and we trusted each other a lot, and we were sort of each other's biggest supporters and also toughest critics. And he told me once, when I, you know, trotted out the first draft of something I'd written, he said, "I think you have an infantile relationship to your writing." What? What do you mean by that? And he said, "Well, it's like you go off in your room, you know, your little writing room all by yourself for so long, and you come out with this thing and you say, 'Here, look what I made. Do you love me?'" And, you know, and I had to completely fess to it. I think, you know, I think as writers, we do want that kind of approval. We do go into a room and make something all by ourselves, and then come out and try to give it to the world and hope that the world cares about it as much as we do. And certainly it is so easy to get lost in your story and lost in your characters. I think, you know, unless you're writing about serial killers, you sort of have to fall in love with them. And that makes you fall in love with the story. And I think it's certainly a way that you get through the long, hard, unforgiving draft after draft after draft But I do. I very much relate to that of I guess having an infantile relationship with my writing.
Well, I think to me that's the beauty of having trusted readers, of having an agent, of having an editor, the people that can have that distance on the story that it's almost impossible for you to have as a creator. I had a teacher in junior high school who, when we wrote our term papers, he made us switch papers with other people in the class, and then we proceeded with an activity which he called baby stomping, which was essentially taking another person's paper, their baby, and, you know, telling them everything that was wrong with it. But it was a good introduction to the idea of what an editorial relationship is like, how you have to give up that creation and allow somebody else to have an objective view of it that you really can't have yourself.
Oh, I think that's a great idea. So I love baby stomping. I've never heard that before, but it's sort of like killing your favorite children, except you're killing someone else's favorite children.
Right.
You know, it is a very hard thing to do, and I agree. I my skin is much thicker than it was when I started writing, but it's still a scary moment when you reveal yourself like that, even to a trusted reader, trusted editor. You know, there is that moment when you have to put it out in the world, and it's scary. I think it's scary.
So you write about how Dickens seeks his inspiration in these long, often nocturnal walks around London. And I think one of the things to me that your book is about, and I especially related to this because it's one of the things that my novel First Impressions is about, is the creative process itself. You know, sort of putting yourself in the shoes of, in your case, Charles Dickens, in my case, it was Jane Austen, and sort of thinking about how they might have come up with what we now view as their masterpieces. But if Charles Dickens derives his inspiration by walking around London in the middle of the night, how do you derive yours? What is your creative process like?
Oh, gosh. I was all prepared to talk about Dickens and his famous night walks and, you know, his probable manic depression and how he dealt with it, and because his walking is such a huge feature. I do relate to that because I live in a beautiful place and I have trails right outside my house. I can hike in the hills, I can hike in the mountains, I can get on a bike and ride. And I do believe that thing about having your feet on the ground gets you out of your head, and that your body somehow knows how to solve problems that sometimes your brain doesn't know how to. And that it's, you know, there is a way of creating being out of doors and walking and looking at the light, you know, shimmering through the leaves, and something happens. And I think it's quite a magical something, but that, you know, that alters the neurons in your brain and makes you think of solutions you wouldn't have just sitting at your desk. So I'm a big fan of that. I read a lot. I tend very much when I'm writing about a very specific thing, I become almost obsessive. I kind of can't read anything else because it's too distracting. So I read, you know, I would read Dickens. I would read about Dickens. I would read, you know, this biography or some obscure academic paper and as much journalism from 1840 as I could get my hands on. I really believe in just filling the reservoir, as you know, until it's just about to spill over, and then starting to write.
I love what you say about moving. When I was writing First Impressions, when I was just sort of working out the background of the novel, we were in England and I was training for a marathon, so I was taking long runs every day or two. And I found out, as I was taking these runs, I was sort of coming back and writing all these notes because I would work out stuff in my head while I was running. And I found out later, after the book was published, that one of the little villages I had been running through was where Jane Austen's maternal cousins lived. And I had been running sort of almost under the window of the bedroom where she stayed when she came to visit. So it was this very bizarre confluence. But I think the creative process can do that. It can sort of seep into you in that way.
And there are magical things that happen when you go off wandering.
One of the things I found just delightful and, to me, surprising is when I was on tour with Farther Adventures of Ebenezer Scrooge, people kept coming up to me, and not necessarily older people of all ages, and saying, reading Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol aloud is one of our family traditions at Christmas time. And I thought that was so wonderful that people still do that as a holiday tradition. Was Dickens part of your holiday tradition when you were growing up?
No, I wish I could say that he had been, but no, I actually come to Dickens quite late. When I embarked on this project, I'd read the usual Dickens, which I consider the things you get exposed to in school: Great Expectations, Tale of Two Cities, Christmas Carol, which everyone's read or seen some version of. But it really was this. I started to read him differently and read him more deeply and more widely of Dickens when I started to work on this project. And it really was a process of, letting myself be inhabited by him and his world and his words and the way I thought his mind worked and the way I thought he saw the world. And so I'm actually quite grateful for it because I think, for instance, I don't think Tale of Two Cities is one of his best books at all. I don't think kids should be reading it in high school. But I had a similar experience reading Moby Dick in my early 30s, and somehow I'd missed reading Moby Dick. And I was so delighted that I'd waited because I think it would have been lost on me if I'd been 17 years old, and I absolutely loved it. So, and in fact, I sort of saved, I'd never read Bleak House, and I saved it as a reward for myself when this book was done and out in the world. And so just a few nights ago, I started Bleak House, and I'm absolutely
Oh,
yes.
you're gonna love it. It's such a good one. It's funny, your experience with Dickens sounds not unlike mine, and I agree with you so much that so often the ones that get read in school are not, to my mind, are not the best ones. And I think part of the reason is they read the shorter novels because that's what you can get through. It's hard to get through David Copperfield or Bleak House in a high school semester. But those are some of my favorites. Do you have a favorite?
I'm sort of worried about this question because I turn it around. I know it'll come up, and I turn it around in my head. I'm holding out hope for Bleak House that it may become my favorite because it is for so many people. But I really loved David Copperfield. I think it's obviously his most autobiographical novel, and it's I think because of that, I feel closer to it, especially because I read it for the first time while I was working on this project. And I felt very close to him when I read it because I knew all of the points of contact, all of the overlap between his actual life and David Copperfield's life. And so it was a very sort of, intimate and moving read to me in a way that it might not have been if I hadn't been working on Dickens so intensely.
I have to say, Copperfield is my favorite, to the point that in Further Adventures of Ebenezer Scrooge, I actually had the aging Ebenezer Scrooge sitting in his sitting room reading a copy of David Copperfield. I didn't specifically title it, but I gave enough hints that an astute reader would easily be able to figure out that that's what he was reading.
I really love that.
So because I was writing a continuation of one of Dickens' stories, and I was trying to make it sound like what if Charles Dickens himself had written a sequel to A Christmas Carol 20 years later. I very consciously imitated and even plagiarized Dickens' style. How did his writing style affect your own?
I did struggle with that a little bit because I knew, he is the inimitable Boz, and I didn't want to. I knew I would fail if I really tried to imitate him, but I also wanted to have fun with it and be playful with the language, and I wanted it to have that kind of Dickensian Victorian feel, but some kind of modernity in it as well that was recognizable. I have to say that one of my influences is Shakespeare in Love, which is a movie that I adore. And I always say when people ask me, well, what book is it like? I often say, well, if Shakespeare in Love had been a novel, I would say, I really use that as a model in many ways. Because I love the winks and nods and the anachronisms, and it makes Shakespeare more knowable because it makes him modern and relatable in ways that would be hard to do if you really tried to only use Shakespearean language. And so it was fun. I mean, I think people do feel that it is Dickensian. I get people have relayed that to me. But I never set out. It's so hard, and hats off to you, for doing it. But it's so hard, I think, to approximate Dickens because he's just such a genius with words.
But do you think that writers today can still learn a lot about the craft of writing and even the craft of plotting a novel, let alone the language, from reading Dickens?
I do, absolutely. And Jane Austen and Herman Melville. And, you know, I think there's so much to be learned in all of it. And the amazing thing to me is that because Dickens was writing serially, for the most part, not A Christmas Carol, but he was writing serially, and I don't think he always knew where it was going to go the next month. But he was one of his geniuses was, you know, being able to sit down and have plot points that would leave people sort of at the edge of their seat so that they would stand in line that next month on magazine day and, you know, couldn't wait to read what happened next. So I think he is an ingenious plotter, and he's a good weaver. He's a tapestry weaver, I think, in many ways, because there are all, you know, so many threads and so many people, and they criss and they cross and they create this beautiful, dense, rich fabric of life. That I just love that, and I think that's we can learn a great deal from that as writers. I learned a lot. It was interesting because I started as a screenwriter, which I think makes me, by its nature, kind of a very much structuralist, but also a minimalist. You in screenwriting, you can never have on the page anything you can't see on the screen. So all interior life is described through dialogue and action. And this was the opposite for me. This was the opposite experience of knowing I had the bones of the story that, you know, as a screenplay is sort of the bones, the skeletal structure of a story, but that I could use those bones to hang muscle and flesh and find juicy bits of fat and kind of figuring out what was the right shape of it and density and richness and texture. How much is too much? How much is not enough? And I think reading any of those authors, reading Dickens, reading Austen, you learn a lot about that, about the importance of carefully chosen detail, about character, about interior life, about landscape. And so there, to my mind, there are no better teachers, really.
I go to a lot of book clubs, and sometimes when we get on the topic of Dickens, I say, which novel should we read? Which novel should we read? And I always suggest that they pick one of the longer novels. They pick Copperfield or Bleak House, and then they read it the way that Dickens imagined his readers reading it, where you get to read about 3 or 4 chapters, and then you have to wait a month before you can read any more. And I think it would be a fascinating exercise. I haven't run across a book club that's done it yet, but I think somebody ought to try that.
Fabulous idea. In fact, I know someone wrote to me, a librarian who's in an all Dickens book club. And all they do is read Dickens. And I guess when they get to the end, they start again.
Fantastic.
But that would be a wonderful way to read one of Dickens' books, to read it serially. I love that idea.
So we've touched on this a little bit, but you paint a lovely, evocative picture of early Victorian London. What sort of research did you find most useful for sort of discovering what the city really looked like and felt like in 1843?
Well, I've lived in London 3 different times. And not for a long time, but I myself have done a lot of walking through the streets of London. And I don't think so much of the Victorian architecture remains. In fact, you know, that's because of the Great Fire. That's really what the bulk of London is Victorian architecture for the most part. If you take away the last 50 years. But so I think, honestly, it doesn't take very much imagination to walk the streets of London and imagine what it would have been like. The streets are paved now. There are many modern touches, but you turn a corner sometimes and you could be in 1843. It's quite easy to imagine. And then I spent a lot of time at the Dickens Museum, which I loved, and is still there, and I guess has just had a wonderful renovation. But there's also the rabbit hole of the internet, which is, you know, I mean, my Dickens library is extraordinary. I have all these books, and I still take out my books all the time. I love early photography of London. But once you sort of discover those treasures on the internet, you can spend a whole afternoon looking at one street or looking at, you know, descriptions of what the lace undersleeve of a dress would have been in 1843, or the, you know, the upholstery on the sheds, or the this particular street corner, this particular pub that might still be there. So I love it. I think the hard part, and I'm sure you would agree with this, is when to stop.
Because absolutely. Yeah.
Could spend, you know, an entire day and maybe not even write a paragraph because the research is just so compelling.
And I think we've all read novels where the novelist was showing off how much research he or she did rather than concentrating on the story. And I've had that same experience. I'm working on a novel right now that's set in New York City around 1906. And unlike London, you can't really go back there and sit on a street corner and see what it was like. So it's been a different kind of research for me. And I've had to sort of rein myself back from saying, you know, Charlie, if you don't have the exact schedule of the 9th Avenue L, it's not really going to ruin the story of your book. But you try to get these things right. So your book, like my book, yours doesn't necessarily require the reader to have read A Christmas Carol in order to enjoy reading Mr. Dickens and his Carol. But you certainly make many, many allusions to the original, and knowing the original story will enrich, I would say, the experience of reading your novel. How do you deal with those dual audiences, knowing that some of your readers will be intimately familiar with The Christmas Carol and some of your readers, you know, saw the Muppet version and that's about it?
Well, I would be thrilled if they had not read A Christmas Carol, if they closed this book and pick it right up. It's 45,000 words. It's a very, very quick read. But it's a good question. I mean, one of my worries was the other side of it. I really did not want to offend all the fantastic Dickens scholars and biographers who might be offended by the liberties that I've taken with the book and with Dickens as well. But on the other side, I think even if you haven't read, if one hasn't read A Christmas Carol, so many of its elements are iconic and live in the culture in their own way. Everyone knows who Tiny Tim is, even if you haven't read the book. If you've seen It's a Wonderful Life, you know, I think that owes a great deal to A Christmas Carol. There's so many movies and, you know, books that are derived from this idea that we have. And so I feel pretty confident that the book almost kind of lives in our collective DNA now. And you don't have to have read it to have understood what it's about and what it means. But again, I do hope it's such a lovely read. I do hope if anyone hasn't read it that they will run to get a copy as soon as they finish this book.
I can remember sitting in a radio studio, I think in San Diego, when First Impressions was coming out, and the hostess asked me, what would you like people to take away from this book? And that was my response, is if they would go and read Jane Austen as a result of reading my novel, that would be, you know, a fantastic thing. I'm a collector of Lewis Carroll books and Alice in Wonderland, and I've maintained for quite a while that there are two books more than any other that do exactly what you say, that reside in the collective conscious and even subconscious, in spite of not necessarily having been read by everyone, and that's Alice and A Christmas Carol. I think more than any others, everybody thinks they know those books, even if they haven't read them. They know the characters, they show up in political cartoons, and it's a fascinating thing to me how a book can become a part of a culture at such a deep level that even if many people in the culture haven't read the book, they still feel that it's a touchstone in some way or other.
I agree. And you bring up Jane Austen, it's always fascinating to me. I think as with Dickens, there's just an insatiable appetite for all things Austen and all things Dickens. And it's funny, Charlie, because one of the screenplays that I wrote fairly early on in my career is a time travel Jane Austen romantic comedy. And so I've lived in that world too. We have a lot of crossover.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, I think I wonder about especially young women still turning to Austen today, which I really love. But I think it's that, you know, in many ways, she was writing about women coming of age and coming into their adulthood in a society that put tremendous pressure on them, tremendous constraints, and how much her characters fight to become who they are, to become themselves within the constraints of Regency England. I think she does that so brilliantly. And I think, you know, I think young women are still having to do that. They're still trying to become themselves when when also having to deal with the constraints of our society.
And I think you've hit on really why great works of classic literature remain great and remain relevant. It's not because Shakespeare was a great poet or Austen was a brilliant stylist or Boz was the inimitable Boz. It's because they wrote about things that are still relevant today. They wrote about the deepest levels of the human condition. And I think your point about Austen, I said that again and again, that the way she depicts the choices and the position of young women in society is incredibly relevant for today.
Absolutely. And, you know, they say, of course, that the way you, you know, the way you understand a character, the only way you can really understand a character, even more so in screenwriting than novel writing, is by putting them under pressure and seeing what choices they make. And that's, you know, that's so much what she's doing, not just in the plotting, what Jane Austen is doing, not just in the plotting of her books, but in using these societal constraints as the pressure her characters are under. So I think it is relevant.
So one of your characters has this to say to Charles Dickens about the experience of reading his works. She says, "I read them aloud to cheer him, each of your stories again and again, and found from the very first page of the very first book the strangest sensation that I did know you and that you knew me, all of us, no matter our faults, our weaknesses, our station in life, that you felt the greatest tenderness for us." Have you ever had that experience with a book, feeling that you know the author from reading the very first page?
I don't know. I have to think of it. It's probably one of those things that will come to me in the middle of the night. But I think that, you know, opening any book is sort of a door into another person and another mind. And often I feel like a voyeur, and often I feel jealous. I feel like, oh God, I want to be this mind, you know, and I certainly felt that way about Charles Dickens often. But I also find that I start many more books than I finish. And I've had to really look at that. I mean, I do lose interest and put things down because I think time is valuable. But I also feel bereft when I finish. And when I come near to the end of a book, even if, you know, the plot is driving me forward, I find myself sometimes slowing down because I can't bear for it to end. And so that, you know, that is a big success when I feel that way, because then I feel like someone has really, an author has really invited me into a world that I can't bear the thought of leaving.
I think one of the nicest comments that I've gotten from readers is when they say just that. They say, I'm only letting myself read a few pages a day because I want to make it last as long as I can. Here's another great quote from Mr. Dickens and his Carol, in this case on the topic of a magic trick. Dickens knew the deception well, but smiled nonetheless, not for the brilliance of its execution, it was on the sloppy end of magic tricks, but for the truth at the bottom of every illusion, every fiction, every lie, our own great desire to believe. Do you think that's why novels work?
I do. I think it's why everything works. I think it's what happens when we open a book or go into a theater to see a play, or when the lights go down in the movie house. I think we want to suspend our disbelief. Sometimes we just want to be swept away and entertained and distracted. But I think much more often what we want is to be swept into the current of another story and be carried along and then dropped off sort of on the other, you know, on a farther shore where we can look back at our own life. And I think that losing oneself in a story, wherever it is, or whatever the venue or genre, that it gives you enough narrative distance about your own life that you can actually see your life reflected back to you. And I am a big believer that, in most cases, the fictional story, the not true story, is more true than the true story. And I say, in fact, in my author's note, that I know I owe a great debt to Dickens' brilliant biographers, but I'm also keenly aware that a biography tells a good story, a true story about a person, but a novel tells us the truth about ourselves. And that, I think, is what the suspension of disbelief is all about.
So we like to end each episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. You should be able to answer each in just a few words, but hopefully it'll give us some insight into your writing and into Samantha Silva. It's not difficult, but it is the speed round. Are you ready?
I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. What word do you love to work into your own writing?
Wonderful.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Wonderful.
Where is your favorite place to write?
In a cafe in Italy, probably in Rome or Bologna.
Where could you never write?
Oh, in the dark, in a movie theater.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Oh, I struggle with so many. I struggle with that in which I've just given up on whether and if. The difference between whether and if. Because I just got tired of paying attention to it.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Walter the Lazy Mouse.
What are you reading now?
Bleak House.
What book would you like to have written?
The Goldfinch.
What sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
Oh, I don't want to jinx it, Charlie. That's a terrible question. Oh, man. A book of poetry.
What would you like to hear a reader tell you?
That they'll read the book every Christmas and that they want to give it to a copy of it to everyone they love.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Samantha Silver, whose novel, Mr. Dickens and His Carol, is available wherever books are sold. The podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary arts nonprofit in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks, its community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore, and all its programs, go to www.bookmarksnc.org. Coming soon on Inside the Writer's Studio, I'll be talking with Emily Wilson about her book on Eleanor Roosevelt, The Three Graces of Val Kill. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.